Bible. And what we were doing at that point was just overviewing the structure and the theme of Exodus. And now the Lord has brought us to chapter 1, which I plan to cover in its entirety this morning. But I think it is important from time to time to remind ourselves to keep before us the big picture, because this is one continuous, one unified book. And every chapter is in some way advancing the theme of the book as a whole. So I'm going regularly to remind us of how this all ties together, where this is all going, and where the various chapters are ultimately driving us. So by way of reminder, the theme of Exodus, I put it last way in this way, that all of these stories and all of these laws and everything else in the content of the book has to do with the Lord bringing this nation of people to a deeper and an experiential knowledge of Him than they had before. So He does that through two main movements, and the first 15 chapters are about the Lord mightily getting them out of Egypt. The rest of the book is about the Lord establishing a covenant relationship with them as His people. And all of those events together are what the Lord desires to use to bring them to this experiential knowledge of who He is as Yahweh. Now, we could break it down a little bit further. And so, if you remember, we looked more closely at chapter 6 in the first 8 verses, which basically give us a summary of the structure or the outline of Exodus. It anticipates the way that those ideas are going to be developed. And I put it to you this way, that it tells us that all of this is about coming to know the Lord in two ways in particular. Coming to know Him, first of all, in the first part of the book, as the one who delivers these people from bondage. And coming to know Him, secondly, as the one who takes Himself, these people, as a nation. He takes them to Himself as a people. He enters into that covenant relationship with them. He spells out for them some of the elements that are involved in really enjoying the Lord's presence and fellowship. And all of these together, He intends to use, and I believe not just in their lives, but in our lives as well, to move us forward in our experiential relationship with Him. Now, that is how the whole book ties together, but we are here looking at the opening chapter, the introductory chapter, and from the beginning, we're going to be told a lot about the people that God is delivering and about their experiences before He delivers them. This is all a kind of a preface, really, for about 4 chapters, introducing us to the situation they found themselves in, to the problem that needed to be addressed. And so this morning, the title of the message is Introducing God's Enslaved People. We're getting to know who they are, what their slavery is about, their desperate need of deliverance, how they are responding to this enormous trial, introducing God's enslaved people. And as I often do when we are particularly going through Old Testament narrative kinds of passages, I do tend to approach these stories inductively. We were just using the word inductive in Sunday school this morning. And in this case, what I mean is, I am not going to tell you at the front end the main point of this sermon. We are going to gradually get there as we read through the passage section by section, as we become aware of some of the smaller pieces and the smaller ideas and how they lead us to the overriding truth that this whole chapter is designed to communicate to us. And so then when we get there, we'll be in a good position at the end of the sermon to apply this to our lives. And so that's the nature of what we'll do. Basically, the question that this chapter is answering for us is who are these people who need deliverance? Where do they come from? How did they get there? What are they struggling with? Why do they need to be delivered? Who are these people who need deliverance? And let's read as we get started from chapter 1 and verses 1 to 6. Here's the first bit of introduction. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. But verse 6, then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. What we're looking at there is material. I pointed this out last week, is information that is almost verbatim copied from the book of Genesis, chapter 46. We're not going to take the time to look at it. Actually, the list of names and the information in Genesis is a lot more developed. This is a little bit of a summary to link these two books together, to see this as the next installment of the same story that you had been reading about in the lives of the patriarchs in the book of Genesis. And as you look back on that, as you look back on the story, particularly of Jacob's life and of the lives of his children and of the conflict between his sons, most of them, and his one son, Joseph, and how he ended up kidnapped and sold into slavery, and he ended up in Egypt, and he ended up suffering there, not for anything that he had done. And he ended up yet amazingly, not just delivered, but after all kinds of unexpected and fascinating events, the Lord is working not just to get him out of jail, but he ends up installed as the second highest in command over the entire nation of Egypt, as somebody who is a foreigner to that land, who has no connection to these people, who really has no experience in governing, but it was clear that the hand of God was on Jacob. And all of his story comes to a climax as he is elevated to that position of authority, and then the Lord, through a famine that he predicted, brings his whole family there and reconciles them to each other. What is that all a story about? Well, there are many themes that are developed in the story of Joseph and his brothers, but I want to suggest to you that maybe the biggest idea that we take away has to do with the providence of God and how the Lord, not just in general, but really through the sins of his own people, ends up able to weave together this complicated narrative that in the end achieves what he wanted to achieve. And of course, the key statement of that is in chapter 50 and verse 20, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And by listing the names of those brothers right here at the beginning, and by reminding us of all of those events, and especially talking about Joseph, who was already in Egypt, you're supposed to be reflecting on what happened and how he got there and all of the intrigue involved in that process. The people now that are going to be under discussion, the people that are going to need the deliverance, are the present generation from that same line. And it's as though here at the beginning, the Lord is saying, yes, things look really bad for you people. And in fact, things are going to look a lot worse before this is over. But you need to remember that your ancestors went through a lot of unexpected, burdensome, mysterious suffering that appeared to make no sense at all, that appeared to challenge the concept of God's promises and appeared to make it look like he could not be trusted. But if you reflect back, how through all of those incidents, by his providence, he was unswervingly moving things step by step forward to get his people exactly where they needed to be for that time. And he did just some amazing things in his providence in the life of Joseph and his brothers. You people now are connected to them. You're the next installment of all of this. And the idea of God's providence is brought to the forefront, that they are there by God's providence, and that as they look back, they ought to be able to draw on those stories to be confident that God in his providence now is also going to work on their behalf. So that's the very first thing we encounter about the people who need deliverance. We're going to read pretty soon about all their problems and their bondage. But before that sort of negative note is introduced, here at the beginning, what is being emphasized is they're there for a reason. They are there by the hand of God. They have a rich and long history of God doing all kinds of unexpected events in order to accomplish what he intends for them. They are beneficiaries of the providence of God. But it does come to verse 6, which says, "Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation." And the question is, okay, what next? And this is a whole new kind of scenario. And there are new challenges that these people are facing. What is going to become of the descendants of Joseph and his brothers? That little line there is intended to shut the door on the past, to shut that chapter of the story, and now a new chapter is opening. How is it that God's providence is going to work going forward? But before we get that, there is one other very reassuring statement about the Lord and his relationship to these people. And it's another verse that I read last week, and that is verse 7. "But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." Here is one of the things that is happening to this generation. And the providence of God continues to work, particularly in the fact that there is so much by way of human reproduction that is taking place. Now, somebody reads that and it's like, well, obviously, people get married and have children, and babies are born, and things tend to expand and get bigger over time as people have children. Why would the author stop and make that comment? Well, I believe that that is put there to make another positive note here at the outset, that in addition to these people having a rich history of the providence of God, they are also as well in the present. They are heirs of the faithfulness of God. They haven't seen everything about God's promises coming to pass. They are about to face a crushing oppression. There are a lot of questions that they would face, but they could, if they had the eyes of faith and connecting their experience with the stories about their ancestors, they had visible proof all around them that the Lord had not really forgotten about them, as they might be tempted to think. That he was actually already in the present and up to this point fulfilling the promises that Abraham would have an enormous seed or group of descendants. And I mentioned last week that those statements are not reminding us just of the Abrahamic covenant about the descendants, but the wording actually takes us back all the way to the beginning of Genesis, because some of these same words are used in Genesis 1 to speak about the original blessing that the Lord gave to Adam and Eve when he said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." And that is what is happening in this piece of the earth. These people are being fruitful and they are multiplying and they are filling their land. In fact, it is repetitive and synonymous and overlapping language here for the sake of emphasis. Notice how many different ways he makes this point. They were fruitful, they increased greatly, they multiplied, they grew exceedingly strong, the land was filled with them. Do you think the author is trying to make a point here? He really is going on and on about this, adding unnecessary words to just shout, look at what is happening. These people have expanded incredibly, and they are so much bigger than how they started. In fact, the word translated multiplied occurs in another sense in Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 20. If you remember this, when the Lord created some of the animals, and he's talking about animals and creeping things and so forth, and he says both about them and about other kinds of animals, there's this idea of a lot of reproduction and very quickly and a lot of these creatures coming into existence. He says that he wants the earth to teem with them, T-E-E-M. It's a way of describing abundance. And it's a way we could maybe translate as he just wants all these creatures just swarming everywhere, right? We talk about cockroaches reproducing so quickly. And if you see one in your house, there's probably a whole colony of them, right? That actually is an extension of what God said in the creation account, that the earth would just teem, like just overabundance through reproduction of various creatures, although I'm not sure if cockroaches are part of the curse or part of the original, now that I think of it. Anyway, you understand what I'm saying. And now he uses that language and that kind of imagery to speak about just how many babies are being born to the people of Israel. He's trying to get you to see the Lord has not forgotten you. You are exceedingly growing in population, and you ought to read this again with the eyes of faith, that this is the faithfulness of God. You got to keep all that in mind, because things are going to get pretty dark pretty fast. But he's framing it by highlighting both the providence of God and the faithfulness of God. Those are the people who are going to need the deliverance. It's the people who have already experienced so much of the Lord's covenant working for them. But it does move on, and we discover pretty quickly that at this particular point, they are suffering subjugation. And I'll read for us, starting in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. At this point, those people who had seen so much of God's faithfulness are suffering subjugation, bondage, slavery at the hand of Pharaoh. And we want to think a little bit about what Pharaoh was up to, what was going through his mind when he said the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. There's an interesting background to this historically that is probably the explanation for his concern. And that is that in a previous era of the history of Egypt. A group of foreigners that are collectively known as the Hyksos had actually become so numerous and so mighty that they were able to take control of the empire. And this began to happen really about the same time that Joseph and his family were going into Egypt. And eventually these outsiders who came in, maybe because of the famine or whatever other reason, came to have such a dominant role that they actually took over. They are foreigners who ended up on the throne as though they were Pharaoh and bringing the Egyptians under their rule. Now, you can understand something of this just in general. Most nations, there tends to be a bit of a hesitancy when you get to have too many outsiders who have a different language or different culture or different ethnicity or different idea about government and so forth. You tend to get a little nervous about what is this going to be like in the future? What is this country going to be like for my children and my grandchildren? And of course, you layer on top of that racism and prejudice, and probably there's some of that going on here as well. But there was actually a concrete illustration that the Egyptians had been overtaken in the past. They regained control of the empire, but now they have this group of Israelites that is presenting the same kind of threat that the Hyksos had done in past generations. And he is afraid that they would outnumber them, or that they would develop enough military power that they would fight against them. And you read the language here, it says, fight against us and escape from the land. That is one way to translate it. And with that in mind, it may have been that there was still a positive dimension to having the people of Israel there, that they were good for the economy, and they were making contributions, so we want to keep them here, but we don't want them to get too powerful so that they could fight against us and escape, and we would lose the financial advantage of having them. That may be what he is saying, but actually the expression there could also be translated that they would fight against us and take possession of the land, not escape, but actually, like the Hyksos, end up being the ones in control, taking possession and authority over it. And so Pharaoh has to have some way to solve this problem. And his solution is to use his present power to enslave them. It speaks there of taskmasters, verse 11, to afflict them with heavy burdens. And they end up building some of the monuments, kind of which we see even to this day in the pyramids and the great structures of ancient Egypt. This is bad news for the people of Israel. This is unfair. This is oppression. This is the abuse of one power over another. There is, from the standpoint of a biblical worldview, no explanation or rationale for this. This is totally out of keeping with how divine image bearers ought to treat each other. And Pharaoh here is presented as an anti-God figure. He is presented here as somebody who is unreasonable, self-oriented, harsh, and all of the rest. And yet, even in the middle of that, for as bad as this is getting, did you notice the wording of verse 12? But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And actually, in Hebrew, those tenses, I think, would be better translated this way. The more they were oppressing, the more they were multiplying, and the more they were spreading abroad. The idea is that this is going on over and over again. It's a kind of a process at this point. It's repetitive in nature. And this is not what you would expect when a people are enslaved. You would think that because they are so crushed in spirit, that it would kill people off, it would somehow diminish the reproduction process, but actually it ends up only contributing to it. How does that work? I'm not entirely sure. But I think we're seeing here a mark of the providence of God. And it's not that just they kept reproducing. It's that the more they were being enslaved and oppressed, the proportion of reproduction went even higher the more they multiplied. That is a bit mysterious. And it is set there in contrast to all the bad stuff that all of this other was going on and even getting greater and greater in and through the slavery. Mysteriously, again in the providence of God, the difficulty moved ahead a certain part of the purposes of God for them. Well, naturally, Pharaoh's going to need to deal with that, and so the bondage gets even harder in verses 13 and 14, and just like you had emphatic, repetitive language about their multiplication, now there is emphatic, repetitive language about their slavery. Verse 13, they ruthlessly made the people work as slaves. They made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work. They ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Somebody has said that as you read this in the original, it's like with each little clause, each verb that comes along, you can just hear the crack of the whip. It's like, snap, there goes that whip, there it goes, and smites somebody on the back. There is somebody else being abused, and each phrase is just like one beating after another. We really need to sympathize with the degree to which these people were suffering. That is how they are being depicted, and yet somehow the purposes of God are advancing. What's going to happen next? It's actually going to get worse as you read what remains in the rest of the chapter. They are now actually threatened with decimation in verses 15 to 21. Verse 15, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? And let the male children live. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Now, you notice there the same combination of ideas where in general it's about all this bad stuff happening and it keeps getting worse, but there are these glimmers of hope that God hasn't forsaken these people and that even through it, he is continuing to move things forward. That's often hard for us to recognize when we're in the middle of some crisis or trial. It's like the bad stuff is huge and overpowering, and we are blind to the many things God is doing. Maybe they're not as impressive. Maybe they're not as amazing or likely to turn things around, but they are still indications that the Lord is at work, that this suffering doesn't mean he has forgotten us. The author here is trying to bring it out on the table that, yes, you've got Pharaoh, but you've got these other characters and these other dimensions. Keep it all in perspective. This is not the only thing going on. Now, let's think about the events then. We don't know a lot about these women, Shipra and Puah, and it is unlikely that they were the only two midwives for this mass of Israelite people. They were probably head nurses, or somehow the ones who were supervising the midwives that serve the women of Israel. And they are approached by Pharaoh and told to kill the males who are born. It doesn't take that much creativity to figure out why he laid down the rule that way. It is because typically it was the men who ended up becoming physically strong, who ended up becoming potential soldiers and combatants, and the kind of people who would develop the power to overthrow the Pharaoh and his forces. And it was probably also with the idea that leaving the females behind, they could then be married to Egyptians, and in that way sort of water down this growing body of Israelite people. And so both of those ideas were probably in play here as Pharaoh comes up with a strategy for killing the men, the boys. The real question we have is, what about these women? And the fact that it seems they lied to Pharaoh. When they give him this explanation that our women are not like the Egyptian women, they're vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. You have whole articles and chapters devoted to the ethical question that arises here as to whether or not it was an acceptable thing, a moral thing, for these women to lie in this situation. So what would be our understanding of that? How should we answer that question? And the first thing I would say is that, going back to inductive Bible study, it is not the point of this passage to answer ethical questions like that, or to resolve all of the debates that we might have about dishonesty and when it might be appropriate. So that really, whatever we come to conclude about that is going to be a matter of our own inference that would be difficult to defend simply on the evidence of this passage. In fact, the passage doesn't commend them for being dishonest. It mentions that they fear God. It mentions about their saving the lives of these babies. And lying was a part of the process, maybe, but that part is not singled out for some kind of divine approval. In other words, anything we say about that, we are taking a few steps of logic beyond this text. It becomes very difficult to answer that definitively. Some people actually do infer that in warfare, this was a near warfare situation, or in terms of excessively oppressive governments, it is not only acceptable to resist and to engage in civil disobedience, which is what we would call this, but that it is actually acceptable in cases like that as well to deceive. Now, the reality is that all warfare that everybody does involves some measure of deception. You realize when a group of soldiers goes out on the field in camouflage, the whole point is to disguise themselves and make it look like they aren't there when they really are. That's a form of deception. And most countries have spies who are pretending to be somebody who they are not in order to get intelligence. And there's all kinds of intrigue that goes on in actual battle strategies as far as trying to make the enemy think you're doing this, but that's a ruse in order to get him off track so that you can do this and have a greater advantage over him. All of those are forms of deception that happen commonly. Good grief, it happens when you're playing basketball, that you try to fake people out. So that is a kind of deception in those kinds of conflicts, whether sports or in warfare. So that sort of thing is part of the argument, as people say, that in extreme situations like this, lying is acceptable because it is going after the greater good of saving lives. Now, as I look at this, I'm not even sure that the women did lie. Listen again to what they say. Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. These are slaves, and these are women who, because of the hard circumstances of life, developed greater strength than probably the pampered women of the Egyptian court. And they were not so dependent on helpers like midwives, and they were able to go through this process by themselves. It is possible that that's actually a true statement. And that is a legitimate generalization about how these birth processes worked for the Hebrews as opposed to the Egyptians. So we come to this, and I'm not even sure that they did lie, so that makes it even harder to answer the kinds of questions that people bring to this text. Now, whatever the case, what is really surprising to me is that they come up with this explanation. Whether it's legitimate or just something of a bogus story. And what happens? How does Pharaoh respond when they say this? Verse 19, they give him their explanation, and Pharaoh doesn't do anything. I mean, if I were Pharaoh, I might have been tempted to say, that is pretty lame, ladies. Really? Or fire them as the midwives and get his own people to be the midwives. Or provide some kind of accountability to make sure that this doesn't keep happening. Pharaoh just drops it. It's just incredible that he would just drop it with what might be a lie or just some ridiculous story or a stretch of what's going on, whatever the case might be. Again, the providence of God is at work in his response and as well in the courage that these women are exerting, demonstrating as they are protecting these babies. This was sort of the original pro-life movement, right? So those of you involved in that whole arena and working at the pregnancy center, this could be kind of like your life verse, right? These women who devoted themselves to saving children from destruction. And what does the Lord do in response to them? They had this fear of God. It moved them to protect life. And then it says, God dealt well with them. And now for the third time, the people multiplied and grew very strong. Like, even more babies are being born here. And in this case, it was not just through normal reproductive processes, but it was through the courage of these women who would not go along with that decree. And the Lord blessed despite Pharaoh's efforts, and he blessed through the courage of these women. In fact, it goes on to say that he rewarded them for their actions, and he gave them families. Whether they had families before, I don't know, but if they did, this is evidently over and above that, and they get a special blessing, and it wasn't money, it wasn't something like that. It was more children, which was the very issue that was the focus of this scenario. There's an irony in all of this, that not only is all of this overturned through their actions, but actually the Lord ends up blessing them personally with more children. They got more of the very thing that Pharaoh was trying to use them to snuff out. So yes, they are threatened with decimation, and it was a horrible and scary experience. But through the courage of these women, they are providentially protected, and they actually end up thriving even more. Well, Pharaoh, for whatever reason, just lets go of them, but now he has another tactic, And we come here to the last verse and the last comment I have, that they are facing a truly dangerous future. It says in verse 22, "Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, 'Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live.'" So now he does commission his own people to get involved in the process, not to kill the babies right off the bat, but to actually take whoever is a male and throw him into the Nile and deal with the children in that way. There may, again, be more going on here than we would perceive because of the background that is probably behind this. The fact is, and we'll see this as we go on into Exodus, the Egyptians associated various objects of nature with various gods that they worshipped. And one of them was actually the River Nile itself, that was recognized as a kind of a deity, and that really gave this nation its sort of rallying point because of how much it supplied for their agriculture. It was viewed as a sign of blessing, that there was rain and that there were these bodies of water and that they had this famous river right down the middle of their country to provide for them. And it's as though as he wants these babies thrown into the water, it's not just killing them, but it is actually an effort to slap Yahweh in the face, like, my God is going to eat your babies. That probably was part of his thinking. And speaking of irony, what was at the very end of this whole incident, after the Exodus, that the Lord used to judge the Egyptians? Wasn't it a body of water? And Yahweh used the Red Sea to judge and to annihilate his enemies. And his supremacy is established over against what Pharaoh was attempting to do. But at this point, you come to the end of the chapter, and there is no resolution to this issue right here. The other passages had a mix of good and bad, but here there is nothing positive. There's no kind of pointer toward a resolution. And yet, I'm going to argue that by this point in the chapter, that should not be necessary. That everything they have read, going back to the first verse about the providence of God, the faithfulness of God, his mysterious working to keep these people multiplying and to use the midwives, all of that has been making a case that if you would just keep reading and keep waiting, this threat is going to be dealt with as well. And God is going to use it in an unexpected way to forward his redemptive plan for these people. And that's chapter 2 in the story of Moses, which we will, Lord willing, look at next week. Right now, this chapter ends as a cliffhanger. And yet, you're not just hanging out there. You shouldn't be wondering. What you should be doing is pulling on all the threads that have been developing throughout this chapter to give you the hope and the confidence that God has got this one covered as well, and he is going to deal with this in his time. Now, what's the point of all of that? As we try to wrap this up and to apply it to our lives, what is the overall message of this story? How do these things come together? I would put it this way, and really trying to connect the theme of this chapter with that bigger theme of Exodus as a whole. Remember, it's all about knowing the Lord, experiencing him as your deliverer, and so forth. I just ask you this: how can you know the Lord as a deliverer if you don't have something you need to be delivered from? How can he free you from bondage if you're not in bondage in the first place? How can he be the great and mighty, you know, solver of my problems if I don't have some overwhelming problem that I can't do anything about? The bondage is actually a prerequisite to knowing him. I believe that's one way you could capture the theme of this passage, is that an experiential knowledge of God, often involves intense suffering. The only way that God can be a deliverer for us is if he, in the first place, allows some crushing, enslaving, even overpowering influence over us that we are not able to deal with ourselves. And that gives him a platform to manifest himself to a degree that he has not manifested himself before in our lives. Now, folks, I will confess, that is not the way that I normally think about the hard stuff in my life. I think of it as just something to endure, maybe, and not abandon the Lord about. I think about it as a pain in the neck and an annoyance and something that makes my life harder and keeps me from doing the things that I thought God wanted me to do. But that's not a complete biblical picture of what's going on in suffering. Suffering is a platform for God to bring you to a deeper knowledge of himself. It worked this way for these people. For us, it'll work in all kinds of other ways. So with that in mind, let me leave you with these applications. And a lot of these have to do with adjusting our expectations of what life with God is supposed to look like. What the sort of normal Christian life is supposed to look like. We often have inaccurate expectations of what it's supposed to be like and feel like. And I would put it in these ways. Number one, even God's blessings can lead to new problems. This is a pattern again and again in Scripture that we are rejoicing in one aspect of his goodness, but in the end, it makes our lives harder. And I'm thinking here about all those children that were a blessing and a sign of God's faithfulness, but then it was the numbers of children that end up being the reason that Pharaoh is intimidated and needs to step in and wants to wipe them out. I like how Victor Hamilton puts this. He says, wherever God's unique blessing is on his own, someone, somewhere, is sure to squirm or get riled. In Genesis 12 to 50, it was often infertility that posed a threat to the realization of God's promises. In the opening chapters of Exodus, it is superfertility that poses a threat. It's like over here, we're just cast down and crushed because we don't have any children. And over here, it's like we have way too many children. God's at work in both, but it's like this was a blessing, and it actually opens the door to a problem. Folks, that's life. That happens. That's a pattern. Some other thoughts. This was true in their case, that yes, the Lord is going to step in, but to really set himself up and give himself a sufficient platform, he may well allow circumstances to get worse before he acts to make them better. I have a few more here as we conclude. One reason God brings suffering is to pull us away from reliance on other sources. This is part of this whole knowing God thing. And there is evidence in Exodus, right? Think about the golden calf and other parts of the Old Testament, that while the people of Israel were in Egypt, they actually began to worship the gods of Egypt. And they had, for a long time, a fairly good and comfortable life in that place. But it's like the Lord really had to raise the heat to where they really want to get out of there. They probably didn't want to get out of there before. Life was pretty good. In fact, Charles Spurgeon made this point. He says, in order to cut loose the bonds that bound them to Egypt, the sharp knife of affliction must be used. And Pharaoh, though he knew it not, was God's instrument in weaning them from the Egyptian world and helping them to take up their separate place in the wilderness and receive the portion which God had appointed for them. That may be part of the interpretation of our suffering as well. Don't be surprised if it feels like God is absent. He isn't really, but we often do feel that way when he makes us wait. And on the positive side, recognize that God doesn't always work in obviously divine ways. He is often working behind the scenes through unsung human instruments that he is using to set up to do something else. And that is a story of the midwives. Do you realize, here's another little irony, we never know what the name of Pharaoh is. In fact, you talk about the amount of ink that has been spilt by Old Testament scholars trying to figure out who is the Pharaoh of the slavery and who is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. It just goes on and on, debating and looking at history and trying to figure this out. Who knows, right? But we know the names of these two women who were midwives. I think that's intentional. God's working in these quiet and unexpected ways and through these unsung human instruments. In fact, there are going to be some other women who are pretty significant characters in the development of this story as it continues. The main question is not whether God will deliver, but whether we are going to side with him when the pressure is on. And thankfully, Shipra and Puah model for us the kind of humble, confident faith that is willing to do the hard thing, to stand up for the Lord when the pressure is mounting totally against us. That, folks, is more and more of an issue for us in the secular culture in which we live. The question is not, what is God going to do? God's going to take care of this in his own way. The question is, what are we going to do? Are we going to remain faithful to his word and to his values? This is the final thought here that I believe this passage is driving us to, that is to draw encouragement from tracing God's faithfulness in the past. They were supposed to bring in all of Genesis as the lens that they were interpreting all of this through. And now we don't not only have Genesis, we have Exodus. They didn't at the time, but now we have that story. And the entire Bible, which is one long record of the providence and faithfulness of God. It is the history that gives us hope and confidence for the future. And as you read chapter 1, I believe Moses is intending for us to make that connection. And in fact, that goes all the way through the New Testament. Was there ever another time when an irrational, paranoid, powerful ruler was intimidated by little babies and said, "We got to wipe out these boys"? His name was Herod, and the baby was Jesus. He is the New Testament version of Pharaoh that I hope to come back to next week. But even in the life of Christ, there is all of this about suffering before the glory, right? That's what we're looking at here. And God intends to use that process to bring us to a deeper knowledge of himself. I trust that that will give us something of a grid to have in mind as we assess the trials that we face in our day. And we're going to sing a song that deals with that and really is designed to encourage our faith in the Lord. It's the handout that came with your bulletin, God Makes No Mistakes.